Artemis II launches to the moon, this week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah El Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. And boy, did we go beyond this week. Four astronauts, Commander Reid Wiseman, Pilot Victor Glover, and Mission Specialists Christina Cook and Jeremy Hansen are currently on their way to the moon, farther from Earth than any human beings have traveled in over 50 years. This week, we'll bring you the sounds of launch day and the voices of the people who lived it. We'll hear from engineers who built the spacecraft, Mark Tobias, who's chief engineer at Northrop Grumman, Jan Henrik Horstmann, European Service Module team leader at the European Space Agency, and Debbie Korth, deputy manager of NASA's Orion program. We'll also get the view from the ground with U.S. Representative Mike Herodopoulos and Senator and former astronaut Mark Kelly. Canadian Space Agency astronaut Joshua Kutrick tells us what it means for Canada that one of their own is headed into deep space for the very first time. Jake Bleacher, who's NASA's chief exploration scientist, and Lisa Carnell, director of biological and physical sciences at NASA's Science Mission Directorate, break down the cutting-edge research happening on this mission. NASA astronaut Steve Bowen shares what it feels like to watch a crew launch knowing exactly what they're going through. And Joel Kearns, NASA Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration, reflects on what this moment means for the future of human spaceflight. Plus, Planetary Society science editor Asa Stahl and our digital community manager Amber Rose Trujillo share what it was actually like to be there on launch day. And of course, we'll wrap up the adventure with Planetary Society chief scientist Bruce Betts, who joins us for What's Up with a look at some of what we've learned about the moon since the Apollo era. If you love Planetary Radio and want to stay informed about the latest space discoveries, make sure you hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform. By subscribing, you'll never miss an episode filled with new and awe-inspiring ways to know the cosmos and our place within it. On April 1st, 2026, after years of engineering, testing, delays, and determination, the space launch system sat on Pad 39B at Kennedy Space Center, fueled and ready to leave Earth. Inside the Orion capsule, at the top of the stack, were four astronauts, three from NASA and one from the Canadian Space Agency. For the first time in human history, a woman, a person of color, and a non-American were leaving the safety of low Earth orbit behind. They were about to go faster and farther than any person from our planet had ever gone before. On launch day, there were a few snags. Teams hit a problem during the end-to-end test on the flight termination stage when they couldn't close the full signal loop between the range and the vehicle. They resolved it by switching to a different range receiver that they pulled from legacy hardware. Then a temperature sensor on one of the launch abort system batteries came back with a reading that was so far out of range that the engineers determined that it was probably just a faulty sensor, not a real problem. So they voted it out of the system. And late in the count, there was a brief dropout in telemetry from Orion. But each time, the launch team assessed it, made the call, and kept going. After a harrowing day, the countdown paused at 10 minutes, waiting for launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson to conduct her final poll.
Attention all Manette, this is the launch director performing the final poll for launch. Verify no constraints and go for launch.
One by one, every team from safety, weather to propulsion said that they were go for launch. But the last people to report in were the crew themselves. Reid Wiseman, who's the commander. Victor Glover, who's the pilot. You'll hear him announce himself as PLT. Christina Cook, mission specialist. And Jeremy Hansen, who's also a mission specialist representing the Canadian Space Agency.
Good airways, Charlie. PLT.
Thank you, Charlie. This is Victor. We are going for our families.
MS-1.
This is Christina. We are going for our teammates.
MS-2.
This is Jeremy. We are going for all humanity.
All right, Charlie. Your Artemis II crew is go for launch. Full send.
I copy that. Reid, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy, on this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team, the daring spirit of the American people and our partners across the globe, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation. Good luck. Godspeed, Artemis II. Let's go.
And with all the safety checks done, after decades of work and determination, Artemis II finally lifted off.
The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. Sound suppression water is flowing.
15.
And here we go. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines linked. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And liftoff. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Among the thousands of people watching from the ground at Kennedy Space Center that day were two members of our own Planetary Society team. Our science editor, Asa Stahl, spent the day before the launch conducting interviews that you're going to hear throughout this episode. And our digital community manager, Amber Rose Trujillo, was there in her role as Lockheed Martin's Orion ambassador. She co-hosted Tim Dodds, better known as the Everyday Astronaut's Artemis II livestream. Both of them watched the rocket climb into the sky together in person. I asked them what it was like to be there. Hey, Amber and Asa, welcome back.
Hi.
Hey, good to be back.
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there who watched your reaction video, the two of you on the beach watching Artemis go up for the first time.
This was my first rocket launch.
What was it like actually being there and thinking to yourself, like, there are humans on that rocket and we're going back to the moon for the first time in over 50 years?
So many different thoughts and emotions raced through my head. I think at first it was just completely being in awe at the beauty of it. It was so much brighter than I anticipated, so much more fire just curtaining out of the bottom of this thing. And then after, I think, maybe the first 5 or 10 seconds, then I started vacillating between being in awe of it and just impressed by what was physically happening in front of me. And then concern, like, oh God, I hope this goes okay every single moment, that works perfectly, that those astronauts are safe. And then I think just a complete thrill that it works. It actually works. And that all of this sort of optimism. I've been interviewing people all day and the day before, all these people involved in the science and who knew these astronauts personally. I had gone to Crew Walkout earlier that day and saw these astronauts for myself, that, you know, these aren't just people on the screen. They're real people. I saw them say goodbye to their families, and seeing that all of these people had such a sense of pride and excitement and accomplishment. And then to live the moment of that being realized, I just couldn't really contain myself.
For me, very similar. It's actually really funny to watch a reaction video and just see our juxtaposition, because Asa is a total golden retriever, just like watching it. And I was just on the verge of tears and ended up like bawling my eyes out. But very similar feelings there. I think for me, I had been working and interviewing and learning so much about the Artemis program around the workforce. And I had just interviewed Robert Lightfoot, who was associate administrator and acting associate administrator at NASA. He was there when the shuttle disasters happened, and he had to help to foster NASA through that. Not only that, but being Lockheed Martin's space president, he had his touch points with Orion, right? This is the capsule that is going to carry these humans to the moon. And then also the SLS itself. He worked a lot on the SLS and the propulsion system. So to see his emotion and his anxiety about it, and it was like that throughout the whole workforce. They had built such a connection to these astronauts. So to be around them and knowing that they had this weight on them, this responsibility, and then to see the rocket at the launch pad, and you're thinking about the astronauts in there, and you know, in your brain, you know that they're anxious. Three of them, of course, have gone to space. The three Americans, Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Cook. They've all been to space, right? Jeremy Hansen from Canada had never been to space. That's not to say that, you know, our American crew were not nervous. They were also the first humans to be on the SLS, right? So there's all that anxiety that I was thinking about for them, and then their families, how anxious they must be watching. So there's all of this like collective emotion around the site. And before the launch happened, Asa and I were sitting waiting for the launch, right? Both of us were pretty nervous. And I hear something. We heard the millions of people on the Space Coast start to cheer from the press site 3.5 miles away. And that really was emotional. And yeah, I think once the hold, the planned hold for the 10-minute clock started to count down, started to get more and more real. And then the 6-minute mark passed, and that's the point where it's going to go. We all started to feel, I think, a little anxious. And then Asa started counting down, and I was just like freaking out watching because I had built up all of this anxiety because I had so many people tell me, well, your wind is going to get knocked out because it's 8.8 million pounds of thrust and it's going to be really, really intense. It was completely different than I thought. And it was loud. Oh my gosh. And bright. But yeah, watching the rocket take off and you're just thinking about how these four humans have put their lives on the line for humanity to do their mission. To them, this is a mission. And it was just overwhelming to be thinking about all those things. And it looks so slow and it looks surreal. It's hard to explain. And then you watch it go farther and farther. And you start to think about all of these things about just please keep going. And please, I just disappear from the atmosphere. And then we saw the booster separation. And I was just at that point a mess. You watch as my first rocket launch, you watch rocket launches on the screen. And you think you understand how it's going to be. You know, it would be more intense watching a rocket launch in person. But I did not expect how intense it was going to be. It has stayed with me. I look at the moon and I start crying.
I think the difference between seeing it on screen and seeing it in person cannot be overstated. Because when you see it on the screen, it's like watching a movie. And there's so many movies about space and about rocket launches. And it just feels like another sort of dramatic episode, right? But then when I actually went to crew walkout and saw the astronauts do the thing that should be in slow motion, right, in any movie, the drama is real. Like, it's not, you know, they say that fact is stranger than fiction. Fact is also more dramatic than fiction. And to actually see the rocket leave the launch pad and then you have to look back and see that it wasn't, that it was still gone. It was as surreal as watching an entire building, as watching like the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty just rise into the air and leave. Except while you're watching that and being like, wow, this is happening. It's that you also know there are people on board.
Yeah. And I also feel like I'm sure a lot of people right now, I was feeling very uninspired lately. Like I knew that this was going to happen, but with everything going on in the world, just on Earth, I was feeling really down. And gosh, did this invigorate my soul.
Millions and millions of people have seen your reaction now online. And you can tell that raw emotion, the truth of it, is resonating with people in a time when we truly need to see what it is that we can do when we come together as humans. I hope that this just comes to you in waves over the course of your lives. Like, this is a moment that you guys are going to be telling stories about for the rest of your existence.
I'm so thankful for the waves that have been coming. To feel the waves of inspiration has been phenomenal, right? Because it's been hard to feel it. I forgot what it felt like. And now to get the gift of it coming over and over when I look at the moon is just like such a gift.
Our CEO, Jen, I reached out to her for comment for the article I published on just the day of launch itself. And I think she nailed it. She said, for an entire generation, this is the moment where space exploration gets personal. And yeah, I don't think I could put it better than that. It just feels like the stakes are different now. It feels like our relationship with the universe as a species is different now. And I'm going to always be grateful to NASA, frankly, and to the crew for accomplishing that, and to the Planetary Society for having me go out and watch it, because yeah, that was the single most spectacular thing I have ever seen.
There are certain things in this universe that no screen can prepare you for. Standing in the path of totality as the moon swallows the sun, pressing your eye to the eyepiece and seeing Saturn's rings for the first time, actually seeing them hanging there, real. A rocket launch is like that. It's something you simply cannot understand until you've experienced it yourself. Back on the ground at Kennedy Space Center, the crowd watching the launch included the people who fought to fund it, the people who built it, and the people who had simply waited a lifetime to see it. The day before liftoff, our science editor Asa Stahl walked the grounds of Kennedy Space Center and spoke with many of them. One of them was Representative Mike Haridopoulos, a Florida congressman and chair of the Space Subcommittee in the U.S. Congress. He was one of the key voices in Congress who fought to keep Artemis 4 and 5 funded through the reconciliation bill after the White House proposed ending the program after Artemis 3.
Well, I think these missions really capture the imagination of the American public. I mean, when I talk to my parents' generation, they talk about one of the most memorable times of their lives was seeing an astronaut walk on the moon back in July of 1969. We've not been back since 1972, but there's a new mission now, not just landing on the moon, but having this moon colony, if you want to call it that. And one of the cool things about this as well is that unlike so many issues in Washington, space is bipartisan.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really work hard to have a great relationship with our Democrat friends who serve on my committee. And we have a really good working relationship. And we just passed one of the big NASA bills unanimously, Democrats and Republicans. I actually offered a few amendments the Democrats wanted. And we work hand in glove because whether it be Republican or Democrats, these American heroes that are taking off today, we want to make sure we support them.
If you could say any message to the astronauts on board right now, maybe just a few hours from leaving Earth and heading back to the moon for the first time in over 50 years, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I say Godspeed. I mean, you talk about the best of the best. You talk about competition, trying to beat another guy out to get the seat on the astronaut, another gal out on the ride here today. And these are the best of the best of America. And we have a Canadian on board as well. I mean, it's a true historic mission. And these folks have trained their entire life to do this. It's funny. I got asked, you guys, will you ever take a ride in the moon? Of course I'd love to do that, but I would never cut in line for a guy who's been working his entire life to go and do this. So we're thrilled for him, and look, their lives are in our hands.
Haridopoulos wasn't the only member of Congress who made an appearance at Kennedy Space Center that day. Asa also spoke with Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, a former NASA astronaut who flew four missions to space, including three on the space shuttle. He also spent time on the early design phase of the Orion capsule that was going to take these people to the moon.
You know, I texted Reed and Victor yesterday, wishing them well, telling them if they need somebody to step in at the last moment, I'm ready. These guys are really excited. I'm a little jealous, I have to say. It's a positive thing for our country. And, you know, we've got a bipartisan delegation here, you know. Tim Sheehy's here. I mean, there's Democrats and Republicans from the House here. Folks from the administration here. We've got a lot of problems, right, our country is trying to solve right now. This is a place that we all can often come together and unite around a common goal. That's hard, but it's doable.
The four people on board the rocket didn't get there alone. Thousands of careers spanning decades led to this moment. Mark Tobias is the chief engineer at Northrop Grumman. He spent 36 years in the aerospace industry helping build the solid rocket boosters that powered Artemis II off the ground. This mission was his last one before retirement.
This is my 36th year of doing this, and so this will be the last time that I actually get to see, you know, a piece of space hardware go in space. I'm going to retire after this, so.
Ending on a high note.
Ending on a high note, yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the Artemis 1 flight was just glorious, and now we've got crew on this one. Mm-hmm. I'm going to drive around the moon. It's going to be awesome.
Is there anything about the rocket or the boosters that you find just genuinely, like, beautiful, like, elegant from an engineering perspective?
Yeah, from an engineering perspective, it's how much raw thrust they put out for really how, in general, how small they are. If you go look at the rocket behind us, the boosters are, you know, not that large compared to the overall vehicle. But each one puts out about 3.6 million pound force of thrust. So that's a lot. And together, both boosters are roughly about 75-80% of the initial liftoff thrust to get the vehicle up and going.
Wow.
The rockets go through a very rigorous qualification program. It starts with components, and then they're built up into subassemblies and tested, and then they're tested at the system level. So for the boosters specifically, we actually go do full-scale, full-duration static firings out in Utah. And so we know exactly how they're going to perform based on the data we gather from those tests. So that's really at the point, you know, okay, yeah, everything's working the way we think it should, and that's where the confidence comes from. It's those very large systems. Level tests,
which I imagine are pretty loud and dramatic.
They're you know, anytime you've got that much thrust and that, you know, 6,000 degrees flying out the back end of the rocket plume is so intense that, you know, we actually pile up sand behind the rocket during our static tests. We do that to protect the concrete of the test bay, but when that plume hits it actually turns it to glass.
Wow.
And you can actually go walk behind the test bay after a test, and you can chip off really, really expensive low-grade glass off the rocks.
Keep it as a souvenir?
Yeah, and we do. We hand them out as souvenirs.
That's so cool. And so for here, in particular with Artemis, I mean, what emotions do you think are going to be going through you as you watch this last flight that you're professionally involved in?
Yeah, for me, it'll be, you know, I think I was 1 year old when we last went to the moon, and my parents tell me a story about putting me in front of a TV and pointing. Obviously, I don't remember that. So this will be the actual first trip of humans to the moon that I actually remember and am intimately part of. So it's a great source of pride in supporting America's program, great sense of accomplishment in what our company and our team does for NASA's rocket, and then just personal pride in being part of it.
Is there anything about this mission that you hope that the public gets the time to appreciate, or that, you know, you think could easily be overlooked but is, you know, significant?
I hope they appreciate that space travel is not easy. You know, it's hard. It's hard work. It's unforgiving work. And, you know, it doesn't tolerate mistakes. So there's a tremendous cast of folks behind the scenes that make this happen. Could be their neighbor, could be a friend that actually does it. Those folks are doing some great work for the country.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure it takes all kinds and a whole space family.
It does. It does.
This mission doesn't just belong to the United States. Attached to the Orion capsule carrying those four astronauts is the European Service Module. That's a piece of hardware providing their power, propulsion, and life support. It was built by the European Space Agency. ESA spoke with Jan-Henrik Horstmann, ESA's European Service Module team leader.
I've been working with ESA, with the European Space Agency, for 2.5 years now, but I have a track record in industry, so I've been on the program in industry a little while back too.
And how does it feel to be finally here watching and seeing what could be, you know, all these years of work finally coming to fruition?
That's a bit, you've summarized it very well. It's a lot of pride, obviously, to be here for ESA, for the European Space Agency, with our service module now flying astronauts for the first time. This is what we've been working for more than 10 years. So it's really, really exciting.
Mm. And how does it feel to hold that piece, that this is the part of the spacecraft that brings the crew home?
It's a great honor for us. It's the first time that the European Space Agency provides a mission critical element to NASA, and we are very proud for the trust that NASA has put in us to provide that vehicle. European Service Module provides electricity for the astronauts with the solar array wings. We provide water, drinking water, potable water. We provide oxygen for them to breathe. We make sure that they are cozy in their crew module with the thermal control system, and of course we have the propulsion system that gets them to the moon and back.
Was there a particular moment when you were doing the integration, when you were putting this all together, where it really hit you, like, wow, this thing that I've been working on for years is actually going to fly to the moon? Or maybe it was with Artemis 1, not with this one, but...
So for me, it's a bit special because I was out of the program for some time. But I would say in January, when we rolled out the rocket and NASA obviously invited us to be there and celebrate, that was really overwhelming. was an overwhelming feeling of pride, of excitement, of seeing it all come together, the whole stack with the launcher, the whole spacecraft. It's just, cannot put into words.
For those who are maybe getting that wake-up call, who are going to see this launch and be like, oh, whoa, we're doing this. Is there any particular, message you want to give them or anything you want them to take away that might more easily get lost in the shuffle?
I think it's often underestimated how much of an inspiration these sorts of missions bring. When I look at myself, Apollo was done 25 years when I was a kid. Still, it inspired me so much to see the footage of the moon landings and all of that. Inspired me to become an engineer and work in space ultimately. It could have been some other domain, but really to become an engineer. And it's for me also, it's a symbol of what we can achieve when we really, really try. And it's standing there. And I, on a personal note, I have my family here visiting, so with two sons, so I really hope that I can inspire them.
We'll be right back with the rest of our coverage of the Artemis II launch after the short break.
Hello, this is Jen Vaughn, your new CEO of the Planetary Society. I am deeply honored to be leading such an extraordinary organization. And one of the very first things I want to do while I get started is to get out to meet you, our members, in person. That's why I'm hitting the road for our 2026 Member Roundtable Tour, a series of small members-only gatherings where we can sit down together face-to-face. I want to hear what's on your mind, your questions, your ideas, and what matters most to you. And while we're together, I'll also give you a preview of the Planetary Society's new 5-year strategic vision. Our first stop will be Tempe, Arizona on Saturday, April 11th, and we'll be continuing on to Washington, D.C., the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, and more throughout the year. We're keeping these gatherings small, so space is limited. Register today at planetary.org/roundtable. I can't wait to meet you.
The European service module may have provided the power and the propulsion, but the vessel carrying the crew was NASA's Orion spacecraft, which is more than two decades in the making. Debbie Korth is the deputy manager of NASA's Orion program. She's been with the program since 2008.
What does Orion smell like? I've heard it's kind of funny smelling and metallic. Is that true?
Maybe a little metallic. Didn't really notice any unique smell. There are a lot of people in there doing work. We're trying to do the final closeouts. We get powered up later this evening and stay powered up till we launch. And so I mostly just smell people there right now. It's pretty busy up there.
What's the first thing you want to learn about Orion itself after the crew splashes down and the capsule is, back on the ship and everything?
I think a couple things. First of all, we're going to be checking out our environmental control and life support systems for the first time. And so we'll be getting a lot of data back across, throughout the mission, but getting some of that data back when the spacecraft splashes down will be really telling. We're looking at how we're removing carbon dioxide, how we're removing humidity, how the temperature control is. So I think those pieces of data are going to be really important for us to learn and make sure those systems operated the way we expect. Also, we'll get a lot of the imagery comes down. We won't get a lot of that during the mission. We'll get some, but not everything. And so one of the first things we get off of the vehicle at splashdown is all of the imagery that the crew members will be taking throughout the mission.
Is that just in SD cards from their cameras?
Pretty much, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of it will be downloaded, but we're limited in the amount of bandwidth we can get down it. So we'll get the majority when it comes back down. I think also at splashdown, we're flying the heat shield and we're flying a different profile for this mission based on what we learned off of Artemis 1. And so we'll get to see the heat shield for the first time after the mission and validate our models and our performance.
Yeah, I've talked to some folks about the heat shield, and the thing that stuck with me most was how long it took even the independent review team to fully understand the problem. At what point in the process did you personally become confident that your team was managing the risk adequately?
Yeah, I think, it was definitely a thorough investigation. We spent, many, many months doing testing. We did about 8 different test campaigns with about 121 different test conditions to make sure we understood the problem. So, for me, there was kind of this eureka moment when the test team was doing some testing, trying to see if we could duplicate this char condition that we saw, this release of char that we saw in Artemis 1, and actually were able to duplicate it in the test chambers there at Ames Research Center. So I think when that happened, it was really gave us the boost of confidence. We understand what's going on now. And then by doing that and duplicating it, we could then test how are we going to change our mission profiles to prevent this from happening for Artemis 2. So I think that was once you can recreate it, then you have confidence that we now understand it much better.
And is there anything about this mission that you wish the public kind of had more time to appreciate? taking a step back for a second?
I'd say, you know, from a technology standpoint, the environmental control system, this regenerative ecosystem that we have, is really, really unique. And so, you know, we're able to remove carbon dioxide, remove hydrogen from the crew module and regenerate the air. And it can last for 21 days for four people. So it's you can actually have much longer missions than we're flying for the 10 days on this mission. I think stepping back more holistically, you know, I think that this shows us what, you know, if we can have a bold vision and we put the resources to it, we can accomplish anything. And so this mission, I hope people are taking away from this, is just the first step. We have, you know, grand plans to return to the moon to stay. And this is our first step. So I'm hoping the public recognizes it's a great mission, but it's just the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, how does it feel personally to see your work hopefully carry people further than humans have been in over 50 years?
Yeah, it's very overwhelming. I have been on this program since 2008, so it's been a long time. So we've got to see a lot of the test flights building up to this point. Of course, flying crew for the first time is just very momentous, and I just can't wait for Wednesday.
Among the four astronauts on board the rocket was Jeremy Hansen of the Canadian Space Agency. He's the first non-American to travel into deep space, and that didn't happen by accident. ASA spoke with Hansen's colleague and fellow Canadian astronaut, Joshua Kutrick. He was there to watch his friend launch.
So I work exclusively almost with the space station side of the house right now, and I'm preparing to fly Canada's next long-duration space mission to the International Space Station, which we're going to do pretty soon. This week, today, I'm here to cheer on my friend, colleague, Jeremy Hansen, and to cheer on Canada. Obviously, I'm very interested in this mission. It's a historic mission. It has profound implications for Canada and for what we hope to do in the future. So I'm here talking about what we do at the Canadian Space Agency. I'll be touring some guests around, that kind of thing. But mostly I'm here to cheer on Canada and watch the mission, just out of personal interest.
And what do you think it will mean for your country when it's done this thing that only one country has done before?
Yeah, you're right to point out that significance. I mean, this is a historic mission to begin with. These four humans are going farther, faster than any human beings ever gone. They're the first crew to go back to the moon, of course, since Apollo. But it's added in importance to us from Canada because, as you point out, the first time that a non-American is going to go into deep space, it's going to be on this mission, and it's going to be a Canadian. And what I like to say is that that's not a coincidence. That's the result of what we've done in Canada with careful investment over decades in space, careful policy. It's a result of, frankly, building things in Canada that aren't built anywhere else in the world, technologies, but that are important to NASA and our partners in human spaceflight missions. So that's how we got here. That's something that has brought a lot of benefit to Canada in terms of innovation and discovery. But it's also something that we're very interested in continuing. If Jeremy was here, he would tell you that his hope is that when we look at that mission, we look at that stack and we watch it fly here in a couple of days, he hopes that none of us see that as the end achievement. We want to see that as just the very beginning of what Canada can do. Our history in space got us to this point, but we want to be dreaming about a future where we have Canadians with NASA, with our partners here in the United States, living, working, doing science on the surface of the moon. That's what we're aspiring to.
What do you see as the future for it, moving forward, to keep Canada on this adventure, doing this exploration?
It's a good question. I am entirely optimistic about the future for Canada and Canada in space. Certainly, you're right to point out, there's no shortage of uncertainties right now. There's no shortage of challenges. There's no shortage of pivoting, transitioning. But I also think that it's sort of always been that way. If you go back to the 90s when we were contemplating space station, I'm not sure there was any less uncertainty at that time. And it's really neat to look back and think forward to now, 25 years later, and look at this amazing thing that we built in low Earth orbit, a crowning achievement of human technology. I certainly hope that the moon is going to be similar. There is a lot of uncertainty right now, but the fundamentals haven't changed. Fundamentally, in Canada, we have a historical proven ability to build, innovate space technology that's unique in the world and that is critical for enabling the next generation space exploration missions. Yes, we might have to pivot, we might have to transition, but we have that capability, we have that industrial base, that scientific base, that engineering base, And I think that if we're careful, there's no reason for why that doesn't continue to carry us forward. So I'm quite optimistic about the future, which is, I think, what space is so good for.
Yeah.
It shows us a future that people can be excited about in a world where sometimes there's no shortage of things to be pessimistic about here on Earth.
For people who are just tuning in for the first time, what would your message be?
I would tell them you live in a very unique time. If you just look around this place, the Cape here in Florida, just in the last couple of years, we've seen the first crewed flight of a number of different vehicles, Dragon, the Starliner. We're now about to watch the first crewed flight of SLS and Orion. Times, in terms of human spaceflight, are without parallel in the past. And that's especially true for a small country like Canada. So I tell them, if you are interested in this, if you're a young person in Canada, for example, or in the United States, wherever you are, and you're interested in space exploration, working in spaceflight, the future really has never been brighter and should be able to get excited about that.
Many people have spent decades working on the vehicle that made this mission possible. But once they actually get to the moon, what do they do there? Jake Bleacher is NASA's chief exploration scientist, and he's been thinking about this question for a really long time.
What single question, if you had to pick one, would you most want to know the answer to scientifically about the moon that you think Artemis might help us answer?
Well, I think if we can back way up, one of the reasons we want to go to the moon is to help understand questions about ourselves, about life. Why is life here? How did it form? Life is on Earth because we have an atmosphere and wind and rain and plate tectonics. But those processes also have erased all of our history of the time period when life got that foothold. So if we want to understand ourselves, big questions, the type of questions that NASA is asked to tackle, we actually need to leave Earth. We need to go somewhere else. And the great thing is the moon, our celestial partner, has been watching the whole time that all these things have happened to the Earth. And it's been recording it. And those records are in the rocks. So that's why we need to go to the moon if we want to understand ourselves. And it's kind of the Rosetta Stone for us to interpret then the rest of the solar system.
Hmm. Is there anything in particular that you're hoping that they do manage to see and that you'd be curious to see the first image of?
Well, I'm actually really curious about, we have a unique opportunity. If we launch on April 1st or 2nd, the Artemis II crew will actually experience an eclipse. So from their vantage point in the Orion, the moon will block the sun.
Wow.
And so they will have an opportunity to be the first people ever, if that were to occur, to see the solar corona off the edge of the moon. So that's just, you know, really unique. Yeah. And really cool opportunity based on the timing of our mission. So I think that one's got my interest the most peaked right now.
Is there anything that has changed for you personally as a result of being a part of this historic mission? I mean, do you feel like your relationship with the moon itself is different, or even just with humanity as a concept?
That's a really good question. I think the thing that has impacted me the most is, you know, flying our friends, our NASA family on this mission. We flew Artemis 1 already and it was robotic. We didn't have anyone on board, but now, you know, it gets real when you know the people personally who are on board. I think just the way our NASA family is integrating and working together to ensure that the mission is safe, and in particular, our astronauts are safe and bring them home. Like, I love to see that as the positive qualities in humankind. And it stretches beyond NASA because that involves partnerships with other countries globally. That's really my favorite aspect of this work that we do.
It seems like the people who are involved in space exploration, space science at NASA, talk about often how these activities for us as a species bring out the best in us. And it's hard not to be optimistic about all of humankind when you do them. But also, it seems like separately from that, in their personal experience, just the act of working on these missions together with these brilliant people who put their all into them just kind of gives you faith in humankind.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I like the way you said it. It brings out the best in humankind, working together to solve hard problems. So we challenge ourselves, or we are given hard challenges as NASA. And so we lead the way and we bring partners in to work with us and bring that best out of everybody.
You may remember Lisa Carnell from last week's episode. Lisa is the director of biological and physical sciences at NASA's Science Mission Directorate, and she's spent 5 years trying to get her experiment on Artemis II. It's called Avatar, a tiny organ on a chip the size of a thumb drive built from each astronaut's own cells, flying alongside the crew to experience everything that they experience. ASA met up with her the day before launch with the experiment replica in her hand.
I see you have something cool in your hands. What is that?
I do. This is an exact replica of the Avatar experiment, the organ chip that is flying around the moon alongside the crew in the Orion capsule. So incredibly exciting.
I'm so glad you brought that, because I was going to ask you as my first question, like, what does it actually look like? And then here you brought. So can you just explain, what's the blue and the pink? Yeah. What leads to that color?
So this is fabricated by Emulate. It's a company in Boston. And we have the blue in here to show this is where we populate the cells that were taken from the astronauts. So we have a stromal cell bed, you know, basically everything that's in your bone marrow. So these are bone marrow models that are going alongside with the crew. So we drew blood from the crew members and we separated out different cell types, their stem cells and PBMCs, and we're able to recreate the bone marrow inside of these chips. And so the blue you can see will be the bone marrow side. And as you can see, like a pinkish red color, this is where the media will be passing through. There's a membrane in the middle that feeds the cells, the nutrients and such, just like your blood would. And then it also removes waste from the cells. And so this is functioning literally like your bone marrow does inside of your body. This is going to revolutionize medicine for us in space, but it's happening right here on Earth. This is groundbreaking across the world. They are using this to replace animal models in so many areas. The human translates, right? If I'm making one of you, I can make this of you. I can make it of you, anybody out there. It translates, right? So when I get the data, I understand what's happening to you personally. So the difference when you're using a model system, the data doesn't always translate. And we see that in a lot of failed clinical trials with 80 to 90% failure rate in different drugs. And so this is incredibly exciting for medicine here on Earth as well.
The science was ready and the spacecraft was ready. But what is it actually like to sit on top of a rocket and go? NASA astronaut Steve Bowen has done it 4 times. 3 space shuttle missions, and a crewed Dragon flight in 2023. The day before the launch, he was there to watch the crew that he knows personally get ready to go further than any of them ever had.
When it comes to the actual physical sensations of being up there, or say during reentry, what does that feel like? Do you feel hot? Is it loud?
Yeah, well, each experience is a little bit different. So what was interesting for me, since I did the shuttle missions and I did the Dragon missions, the space shuttle is sort of like the SLS. It has solid rocket boosters. And so the main engines will come on and they get a little bit of rumble, but then the solid rocket boosters will light and that's a lot more exciting and you're definitely going someplace. So that's that's an exciting ride. The first few minutes, the solid rocket boosters are burning for a shuttle. And then as soon as they went away, it got really smooth, but then you really started accelerating. And so in the shuttle, we peaked out about 3 Gs. Dragon was different. It was, once you get off the pad, it's liquid fuel the whole way. It's a very smooth ride. The fact that you don't have any engines running between first and second stage was disconcerting for an old person like me. Second stage lights, and then you start accelerating, you actually peak out higher than we did on the shuttle. And so coming back, profile is similar in a sense that you were, you're going to peak out on higher Gs. The thing about the capsule landing, and they'll experience this as well, I liked having wings and landing on a runway and walking off the vehicle, having spent a lot of time wallowing around in the ocean, not looking forward to being in a high seas in a capsule. But that turned out just fine. But it's a series of explosions that get you down from, you know, every time the drogue chutes have to come out, the main chutes come out, you get all the different accelerations. On the Dragon, we could hear the sounds pretty well. It wasn't really loud. I mean, you get layers of protection, you know, hearing protection, you get your comm, you get your helmet on. But it's pretty amazing to see. And then the view out the windows as the plasma burns off over the top. So in the shuttle, basically the front windows would be orange. Wow. As you're coming in. On the Dragon, you could see it going orange, and then they would just turn black from being charred on the outside. And we landed at night on my Dragon landing. And it took a while for us to see the lights of the people coming to get us because the char was thick enough. It was pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like being in the microwave.
It was nice. It was that. We do pre-cool the vehicle before it comes back in, so we do the best we can.
I couldn't help but overhear the story you were telling when you're on the space station, and I just think that our listeners would love it. It's exactly the kind of thing that makes us fall in love with space, I think.
Well, yeah, so the story is, and it's true. I don't think I embellish it too much because I experienced it, but we were doing spacewalk. I think it was the first spacewalk on my second mission. We were installing an antenna on top of the International Space Station, and we got done installing with as much as we could do for that EVA, and they took Garrett away, who was my other EVA crew member. So I'm sitting there on top of the space station, getting ready to move on to the next thing, and ground calls up and tells us, stand by, Steve, we're looking at something. And having been around for a while at that point, I kind of attached myself to the top of the antenna on the boom and sat there as we're circling the Earth. I'm top of the space station overlooking the Russian segment as we're circling the Earth for 30, 40 minutes as they were just resolving problems on the ground. And all I could think of is, what kind of civilization is this? You know, I grew up carrying buckets, literally, I grew up carrying buckets of cement for my dad as he laid tile for a living. And how do we get here? What kind of civilization allows us to build this vehicle, this laboratory in space where we're really learning, learning things we never learned, could have learned elsewhere. We're solving problems we never would have asked that help us, you know, here on Earth to live a better life. And it's absolutely amazing. The view was unbelievable. You know, and like I said, I don't think I had to go to space to learn that, but really it hit home. If you look at what we're able to accomplish when we all work together, it's absolutely amazing.
We'll give the last word to Joel Kearns, NASA's Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration. He spoke about how historic this moment really is.
How do you think you'll feel watching this particular mission launch?
Well, it's incredibly historic to have people go back to cislunar space for the first time since 1972. I used to watch the Apollo missions on TV, but I never got to go to a launch. I remember going to the Artemis 1 launch where we had investigations on Artemis 1 and thinking, wow, the next time I see this powerful rocket launch, we're going to have people on the top of it. And that is really emotionally compelling. And of course, I also know what investigations are going to do, so I really want to get them into cislunar space so they can do that so we can get our science return from it. So, yeah.
The people back home at Kennedy Space Center wish them well and promise to follow up as they continued on their 10-day mission around the moon and back.
We're going to continue to follow the crew of the Artemis II mission. They are beginning their journey around the moon to verify the systems that will take us to its surface. An incredible ascent. Artemis II is underway. Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Cook, and Jeremy Hansen begin their journey to the moon. Still milestones to come up. We'll keep tabs on Integrity and its crew from here in Mission Control Houston.
Integrity is the name that the crew gave the Orion spacecraft. And as with all first crewed flights of a new spacecraft, the early hours brought a few things to sort out. There was a brief communications dropout during a satellite handover that left Mission Control unable to hear the crew for a few minutes, although the crew could hear them from the ground the whole time. And there was a controller issue with the toilet that needed some troubleshooting. This is the first toilet to go beyond low Earth orbit as well, but mission specialist Christina Cook took care of it. A crossover valve connecting the water tanks had been shaken closed during the launch and needed to be reset. And a piece of electronics took a radiation hit, the same kind of transient issue that was seen on Artemis 1, but they caught it, and it was handled by onboard fault detection. All of the issues were sorted out. And as I record this, the crew is healthy, the spacecraft is performing, and Artemis 2 is headed for the moon. All of us here at the Planetary Society wish them safety, wonder, and the deep satisfaction of going where no one has gone before. They carry with them the labor of thousands, the dreams of billions of us, and the oldest human instinct of all, to discover what lies beyond the horizon. For a look back at some of the things that we've discovered about our closest neighboring world, I'm joined by Bruce Betts, our chief scientist here at the Planetary Society, for What's Up. Hey, Bruce!
Hello!
We went to the moon, or I guess they're on their way, but it worked.
Road trip.
It totally worked.
It's super exciting. Very, very cool.
It's because we weren't there to see the launch. That's why it went up on time this time.
Exactly.
Yep.
You've learned. I'm very scientific about everything. I don't believe anything of that's, you know, pseudoscience. But, you know, after I attended my fifth or so launch where it didn't launch, I started to wonder.
Yeah,
I'd leave and then they launch the next day. That's typically it. So everyone made sure I didn't go to this one.
Yeah, at least we got to be there to go see Artemis 1 try to launch. Yeah. But oh man, watching Amber and Ace's reaction to seeing their first rocket launch was one of the most heartwarming things I think I've ever seen. That was their first rocket launch, Bruce.
I mean, it was really heartwarming anyway. I just assumed there were like humans on it, which we haven't done for long.
I know, right? I think I'm going to be on like an emotional roller coaster for the next 10 days until the astronauts come home safely. But I don't know, man. We did it. After all this time, finally humans are going back to the moon. Maybe not to land, but eventually. But yeah, there's a lot that's happened in the last 50 years since we went to the moon, clearly. So I feel like we should take a little moment to talk about some of the things that we've learned about the moon in the last 50 years since humans last set their boots in that lunar regolith. God, 1972? It's been so long, Bruce.
I know, I was there.
Yeah.
Well, not on the moon, but I watched the Apollo 17 launch. So.
That's so cool.
Now I've watched this launch, so I feel like my life's been bookended. I'm a little worried. So anyway, we've learned a bunch of stuff about the moon, particularly, I mean, I think the big one, which was really tied into using what Apollo learned, particularly in the rocks that were brought back, was that it distinguished between hypotheses and the one of where it came from and the one that just seems totally whack. Turns out to be the one that's true, which is the giant impact. So you had proto-Earth chilling, getting hit by little stuff, and then along came something not little, like possibly Mars-sized, and slammed into the Earth, stripped off outer layers, threw them up into space, and most of the stuff fell back to Earth, but some of it formed the moon, and you end up with this magma ocean covered moon. And that's been the theory that seems pretty wacky that actually makes sense and fits with what they found. We're finding some rocks that appear that maybe there was volcanism a little, you know, not that long ago, just like a billion years ago instead of 2 or 3 billion years ago. Still, most of the place is 3 and 3.5, 4 billion years old. But that's why the moon, as I ramble on, the real significance of the moon for broad planetary science is that it preserves all these craters and the history of the early solar system, whereas Earth does that erosion thing and plate tectonics and makes things change over time. Whew. Sorry, I got excited.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking on the show maybe 2 months ago, I want to say, about how the moon has kind of preserved this record of things that have hit it before and what that's taught us about how water came to Earth. Like, there's a lot that we can learn from those things. So I'm looking forward to people returning once more, collecting more samples. And it's a complicated thing, but can you imagine if we actually managed to build a lunar base and actually build a permanent presence on the moon? I don't know. I feel like now that I've seen Artemis 2 go up, I've got hopes. we're going to do this, Bruce.
We'll see. It's they've got some hard tasks ahead of them and some currently rough time frames and limited budgets. We'll see. But it's certainly noble intentions and goals, and they may, because I mean Artemis 2, it's doing great, and there's still a lot of great people working on these projects, making things happen, and it's pretty darn impressive, that football field length rocket going up. And did you see that launch yesterday?
I mean, not in person, but I watched it. I watched it and cried. That was such a cool moment, and now I just keep thinking, like, as we're talking right now, there are 4 people in the Orion capsule hurtling around the Earth, getting ready to go to the moon. Like right now that's happening. What a time to be alive.
All right. Let's, shall we move on? I'll keep us in the same general place, but I will still call this.
Rewind.
The Apollo command module. Have you thought of that with three people in it relative to Orion with four people inside it? Orion is bigger. It has a 5 meter biggest diameter as opposed to Apollo command module at 3.9 meters. And Orion has about 30% more habitable volume, but one more astronaut. But most importantly, the real upgrade, I think, is they put a toilet in.
I was going to say, I think the toilet is nice quality of life improvement.
It is. It's, you know, and I believe there is even a curtain, a tiny curtain. And, of course, that's happening in the volume of a minivan or two equivalent. So they'll really get to know each other even more than they have. But they get a great view.
Then it will smell a little weird in there anyway.
That's all I got. That's what I got.
Yep.
So I will be boring and say, look up at the sky and think about the astronauts on the way to the moon and coming back from the moon and space. Thank you and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week with more space science and exploration. If you love the show, you can get Planetary Radio t-shirts at planetary.org/shop, along with lots of other cool spacey merchandise. Help others discover the passion, beauty, and joy of space science and exploration by leaving a review or a rating on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Your feedback not only brightens our day, but helps other curious minds find their place in space through Planetary Radio. You can also send us your space thoughts, questions, and poetry at our email, planetaryradio@planetary.org. Or if you're a Planetary Society member, leave a comment in the Planetary Radio space in our online member community. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our members. From the ones who cheered as the Apollo astronauts walked on the moon, to the new generation only seeing their lunar dreams made real for the first time. You can join us at planetary.org/join. Mark Hilverda and Ray Paletta are our associate producers. Casey Dreyer is the host of our monthly Space Policy Edition, and Matt Kaplan hosts our monthly Book Club Edition. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Sarah El Ahmed, the host and producer of Planetary Radio. And until next week, we're going to the moon, everyone. Ad Lunam and Ad Astra.